Mark did leave out a good Samaritan deed I did for you, and I hoped you would recall it. Please come up here and share what... Oh, you don't remember. Well, the winter of 79, what year did you come?
Oh, yeah, 75. Oh, you're right.
The snow was up to the, the roof line. And I happened to know that Mark was away for vacation during a Christmas break, and I went over and shoveled his driveway. Now, there was so much snow that fell after that that it was not very noticeable, but all right.
Now, I don't know. Did I even know that?
I don't think so.
We're on sabbatical in Gordon, so, but yeah, thank you, Leland.
We've been waiting for the thanks for a long time, Mark. All right, I have such pleasant memories of a previous trip to Southern Seminary that when I received an invitation from Ken Magnuson to speak again, I jumped at the opportunity. I did not look closely at the details, and for no good reason assumed that I would be speaking to students. Then, at a later stage, I discovered that I would be speaking to the faculty. That moment of discovery belongs to the category that I label the shock of a lifetime. I'm honored to be standing before you tonight, but do not feel wholly deserving of the honor. If I misspeak in an area in which you know more than I want you to speak up in the Q&A. I want to be corrected as necessary. My main subject this evening is leisure as a Christian calling. Before I get to that, however, I want to say just a few things about two subjects that are related to leisure that need to be in our awareness as we think about leisure as a calling. Those two subjects are vocation and work. What I have to say about calling or vocation is shared mutually by work and leisure. When I speak of leisure as a calling, I do not abandon the definition that I use when speaking of work as a calling. It is only the application to leisure rather than work that changes. So what is a calling or vocation? I want to start with the word vocation, which is derived from the Latin. When I did the research for my books on work and leisure, I ran across an article that traced the history of the word vocation. From this article, I learned the interesting fact that the person who more than anyone else changed the meaning of the word vocation was Martin Luther. The word had one meaning before Luther made his imprint, and another meaning after that. Before Luther, the word vocation was reserved for people who had entered religious orders and either lived in monasteries and abbeys or served as priests. Luther started a revolution when he claimed that these were precisely the people who did not have a vocation. People who served God and people in the everyday world were the ones who had a legitimate vocation. The word calling expresses the foundation on which all thinking about it rests. A call from God is anything that he commands us to do or be, with the added understanding that God also gives us the resources we need to do what he commands. As I turn now briefly to the Bible on the subject of calling, I have a quiz question for you. When biblical writers use the words called or calling, is the context usually work, or leisure, or neither? When biblical writers use the words called or calling, do they primarily refer to work or leisure or neither? Mark Coppinger, what is the correct answer?
I think it's actually to their salvation and their Christian walk.
So yeah, the answer is neither. Could we just be brief about it? Okay. I wasn't asking for a whole lecture. Actually, Mark is right, and I have been unfair to him. The largest frame of reference for vocation in the Bible is the call to the Christian life in total, which I think is what Mark was trying to say. Okay. We are called first and always to follow God, to serve Christ, and to live a life worthy of Christ in the power of the Holy Spirit. As an illustration only, I'll just quote 1 Corinthians 1:9, which speaks of being called into the fellowship of God's Son, Jesus Christ our Lord. The Puritans looked at the Bible passages that assign primacy to the spiritual call to follow God and evolved a framework of dual callings, a general calling and a particular calling. The general calling is the same for everyone and consists of the call to conversion and godliness. The general calling, wrote William Perkins, the English Puritan, is the calling of Christianity, which is common to all that live in the Church of God. It is that whereby a person is called out of the world to be a child of God. The Puritans used the phrase particular callings to designate the more specific tasks to which we find ourselves called. Particular callings, plural. The Reformers advanced the very helpful idea that our particular callings encompass all of life and not only the work that we do for a livelihood. Any role or task that God places before us is a calling, on a par with our primary job. The author of a book entitled Luther on Vocation writes, "The life of the home, the relation between parents and children, is vocation, even as is life in the field of labor." Still quoting. From this, it is clear that every Christian occupies a multitude of offices at the same time, not just one. All these are vocations. William Perkins described vocation as a certain kind of life, ordained and imposed on man by God for the common good. A certain kind of life that embraces life off the job as well as life on the job. John Calvin wrote that God, quote, has assigned distinct duties, plural, to each in the different modes of life. So our calling includes washing the car and cooking for the family and driving children to an event. Were the Puritans right in viewing our work in the world as a calling? I believe they were. Here are the main points that I develop when I deliver an address on work as vocation. One, work is rooted in the character and acts of God, who is a God who works. Two, God the worker created people in his image and therefore capable of finding satisfaction in work. Three, work is a creation ordinance instituted by God in paradise before the fall. Four, the fall into sin made possible the perversion of work in the forms of overvaluing it, undervaluing it, and misvaluing it. Five, work can be redeemed from the curse. I wanted to put that summary before us so we can see the ways in which the case for viewing leisure as a Christian calling runs a parallel course to the more familiar idea of work as a vocation. With the foregoing framework before us, I will devote the rest of my address to leisure as a Christian calling. I chose that subject instead of talking only about work or dividing my time between work and leisure, because in the circles in which I move, the topics of work and vocation are nothing less than a growth industry. It seems as though every time I turn around, a new book or pamphlet or article on the subject appears. I am happy for the ferment. The problem is that leisure remains what it has always been, a subject of neglect in the church and among Christians. And when on rare occasions a book or article on leisure appears, leisure is considered by itself, without incorporating work into the equation. The reason I have written books that combine the topics of work and leisure is that we will not solve our work problem, as theorists call it, or our leisure problem, unless we take the other into account as a necessary part of the picture. As my address unfolds, we will see why this is the case. I will begin my exploration of leisure with what I call, for lack of a better term, the secular data on the subject. Then I will look at the biblical data, and then make good on my claim that leisure is no less a Christian calling than work is. What did I learn about leisure from the secular sources? I learned very important information about the nature of leisure itself, starting with the etymology of the word leisure. The word leisure can be traced back to two roots, both conveying the idea that leisure is free time. One root is the old French word licere, from the Latin licera, meaning to be allowed or to be lawful, to be allowed or to be lawful. Our word license comes from the same root. That's pretty helpful. In our leisure, we have license to do what we choose. In leisure, we are permitted to do as we please. As an uptight Dutchman, I like that. At least in theory. G.K. Chesterton famously said that the concept of leisure has come to cover three totally different things. The first is being allowed to do something. The second is being allowed to do anything. And the third is being allowed to do nothing. The other derivation of the word leisure is the Greek word skole, or the Latin schola, from which we get the English word school. These words carry the connotation to halt or cease, meaning that in leisure we call a halt to our work and develop ourselves as a person the way we do in our education. In leisure, we are free from working and can expand our creaturely selves. That's also a pretty inviting prospect. Based on this etymology, experts on leisure offer the following as the defining traits of leisure. First, leisure is free time or non-work. Work belongs to the category of obligation, and leisure, by contrast, is free from obligation. This is important. Leisure has to feel like leisure to count as leisure. It has to feel like something non-obligatory. If we pursue a leisure activity as an obligation, we have missed an essential aspect of leisure. Secondly, leisure is defined in terms of certain activities that we normally think of as falling into the category of leisure. Examples are cultural pursuits, recreation, entertainment, hobbies, and social activities. Thirdly, leisure is a quality of life. An expert on leisure once wrote that anybody can have free time. Not everybody can have leisure. Still quoting, leisure refers to a state of being, a condition which few desire and fewer achieve. I found that pretty provocative. I will allow a Christian leisure theorist to provide a good summary of what leisure is in its highest reaches. Leisure is the growing time for the human spirit. Leisure provides the occasion for learning and freedom, for growth and expression, for rest and restoration, for rediscovering life in its entirety. That is raising the bar high, and I think we resonate with that. The foregoing suggests helpful ways of thinking about the nature of leisure. How has leisure fared in American society during the past half century? Surveys suggest that it has not fared well. The biggest problem for most people in our culture is that they do not have enough time for leisure. Overwork on the job is one cause of this, but not the only cause. Remember that work encompasses all work, and not only work done for our livelihood. So lack of time is one component of the contemporary leisure problem. Poor quality of leisure is a second problem. The electronic and digital revolution has lured many people into settling for less than what might be in regard to leisure, and less than what prevailed before the electronic revolution. InterVarsity Press published a book entitled Still Bored in a Culture of Entertainment. Additionally, many people carry the qualities of work into their leisure life so that the element of relaxation and drawing a boundary around work vanishes. I found particularly provocative the comment regarding workaholics that, quote, they are never less at leisure than when they are at leisure. They're so preoccupied with the fact that they're not working and doing this mountain of obligation that they're thinking about it constantly. I resonated with the statement. The advent of email and texting has made it virtually impossible to protect any extended time from the intrusion of work and obligation. Additionally, the case can be made that the professionalizing of leisure has made our supposed leisure less leisurely. The author of the best book on the institution of the weekend, a book entitled Waiting for the Weekend, writes as follows. I'm always charmed by old photographs of skiers that show groups of people in what appear to be street clothes with uncomplicated pieces of bent wood strapped to sturdy walking boots. These men and women have a playful and unaffected air. Today, every novice is clothed in skin-tight spandex like an Olympic racer, and even cross-country skiing, a simple enough pastime, has been infected by a preoccupation with correct dress, authentic terminology, and up-to-date equipment. This reflects an attitude to play that is different from what it was in the past. In the author's summary statement, the lack of carelessness in our recreation, the sense of obligation to get things right, and the emphasis on protocol and decorum represent an enslavement of a kind. That quotation has eased me into an additional problem with leisure today. While some people squeeze leisure out of their lives, others go to the opposite extreme and make an idol of it. Even if they do not spend an exorbitant amount of time at it, though they may, it dominates their thinking. To the disparagement or neglect of work, including obligations around the house, or to the family, or in the community, or in the church, or among friends who need a helping hand. The phenomenon of the endless weekend is well attested, living for the weekend and talking about it the entire week. I've covered two topics thus far. I've talked about what leisure is, and I think that raised our spirits about the possibilities of leisure in our lives. Then I talked about what theorists call the leisure problem, and that left us somewhat deflated, as we recognize that these deficiencies are true of us also. Does the Christian faith offer open doorways into a proper appreciation of the importance of leisure? It does, but we need to acknowledge that leisure has not received its due in Christian circles. The Protestant tradition has elevated work and undervalued leisure. The trajectory was set right at the beginning with the Reformers and Puritans. My heart soars when Luther writes that God put Adam and Eve into the garden for work. Yes, I say. And then Luther adds, not for leisure. Wait a minute, I say to myself. Where do we get that? Why can't we elevate work without demoting leisure? I speak of a great mystery. But surely an evangelical author hit the nail on the head when he titled his book, When I Relax, I Feel Guilty. Why do we feel guilty when we relax? Partly because we have not studied the Bible to see what it says about rest and leisure. I think we should dignify the concept of leisure, construct a Christian defense of it, and then proceed to practice it guilt-free. My thesis for the rest of this address is that leisure is as much a Christian calling as work is. I have found as much biblical data on the subject of leisure as on work. The data is more indirect and inferential than the data on work, but it is present. I will develop six ideas in regard to leisure as a Christian calling. Just as I begin my defense of work with the subject of God at work, I also begin my defense of leisure with the parallel subject of God at rest. The foundational but not final ingredient of leisure is that it is a cessation from work. The great original model for this is God during the week of creation. There is certainly an element of mystery in God's rest, but one of its great uses to us is that it provides an unmistakable model and warrant for human rest. The key text is Genesis 2, verses 2 and 3, which states, "And on the seventh day God finished his work that he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work that he had done. So God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it God rested from all his work that he had done in creation." The strong element of repetition in those two verses produces the effect of emphasis, as though God wanted to make sure that we did not miss the point. Exodus 31, verse 17 adds to the mystery of divine rest by ascribing refreshment to God's resting on the seventh day. I quote, "It is a sign forever between me and the people of Israel that in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, and on the seventh day he rested and was refreshed." I do not know why God needed refreshment, so we should just accept that he did. It would appear that God's Sabbath rest was a day of creation, not a day off. It was a day off from work, but the implication is that the days of creation form a week so that God can be said to have created and instituted the seventh day of rest. A Jewish scholar claims that, quote, "it took a special act of creation to bring the Sabbath into being." What are the implications of divine rest for leisure? The first lesson is that we have an obligation to have times when we call a halt to work. If God did it, we need to do it. Divine rest sets a pattern for drawing a boundary around work and making sure that work is balanced by rest. God's design for the human race is not nonstop work. God's rest not only drew a boundary around work, it had within it an element of enjoying what was already accomplished. The Sabbath and our leisure modeled on it have the nature of letting go of the utilitarian and acquisitive urges that occupy us in the workaday world of getting and spending. In rest and leisure, we celebrate what has already been accomplished and for the moment realize that work is unnecessary and inappropriate. I found that quite provocative as I was working on this address. During the act of leisure, we realize that for the moment, work is unnecessary and inappropriate. I like Kenneth Woodward's comment that the essence of leisure is time off for the timeless, thanking God for what has been freely given and not produced by human labor. I also like the statement of someone else that people who refuse to rest on the Sabbath and reject genuine sabbatical living are those who trust in their own strength rather than God's grace, still quoting, it is only in the sabbatical pause that we can truly open ourselves to appreciate and acknowledge what God has done. God's rest on the seventh day is the first plank in my claim that leisure is a Christian calling. We can model our leisure on God's rest. If God works, he also rests. If God's work is a model for human work, his rest is equally a model for us to follow. One aspect of this model is qualitative, encompassing such traits as rest, peace, joy, well-being, relief from the burden of work, contentment of body, mind, and soul, human flourishing, in short. The other aspect is quantitative. Our time off from work must be substantial and regular. What makes leisure a requirement in a person's life? My first answer is that the rest of God on the seventh day of creation is a model that God requires us to follow. Because Sabbath rest from work is linked to God's work of creation, I'm going to say that it has the force of a creation ordinance, just as work does, a foundational principle that God built into the fabric of human life. My second piece of data is the example and teaching of Jesus as recorded in the Gospels. Jesus did not reduce life to endless work and evangelism. He found time to retreat from work and ponder the beauty of the lily and commanded his disciples to do the same. Here's a typical scenario. Immediately, Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side while he dismissed the crowd. And after he had taken leave of them, he went up on the mountain to pray. And when evening came, the boat was out on the sea and he was alone on the land. In other words, Jesus and the disciples drew a boundary around their work and obligations. Here's another typical passage. The apostles returned to Jesus and told him all that they had done and taught. And he said to them, come away by yourselves to a desolate place and rest a while. For many were coming and going, and they had no leisure even to eat. And they went away in the boat to a desolate place by themselves. If we were to arrange the public life of Jesus into a series of typical scenes, one of them would be Jesus attending what we would call a dinner party, a form of leisure. If Jesus himself, who lived and died to be our Savior, found time for leisure, surely we should do the same. In addition to the example of Jesus' lifestyle, we have his teaching, and in particular his discourse against anxiety in the Sermon on the Mount. I consider this passage, actually a poem, to be a great primary source on leisure. There are two main thrusts to Jesus' discourse against anxiety in Matthew 6, 25 through 34. One is the command not to be anxious about acquiring things like clothes and food. In commanding us not to be anxious about these material things, Jesus is asserting a prime principle of leisure, namely, the need to set a curb to the acquisitive life. Jesus commands us to tell anxiety, don't pass this line. The second thrust of Jesus' discourse against anxiety is the command to contemplate nature and learn lessons from it. Consider the lilies of the field, Jesus says. Contemplating nature and enjoying its beauty are one of the world's favorite leisure activities. Jesus commands us to do it. Thirdly, in addition to the example of God's cessation from work and Jesus' inclusion of rest and leisure in his busy life, we have the command to rest in the Decalogue. The fourth commandment states, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work. To my very great surprise, inasmuch as we associate Sunday with worship, it is unclear how early the Sabbath entailed worship. The emphasis early in the Old Testament is on the complete prohibition of work. When Genesis says that the day is to be holy, probably the primary meaning is that the day is to be separate or different from the other 6 days. In any case, if God commands rest or leisure in the fourth commandment, then it is something that he calls us to do. That is why I do not shrink from labeling leisure a Christian calling. I've talked about the rest of God, a pattern for us, the leisure activities and teaching of Jesus, also a pattern for us, and the fourth commandment, a requirement for us to obey. While my topic of leisure as a calling does not require me to talk about the effect of the fall on leisure, I'm going to do it because I want my address to cover what I have to say on a Christian view of leisure. The effect of the fall on leisure warns us against the abuses of leisure in our lives. The primary data for the perversion of leisure from its godly intention is simply a look around us, where we find empirical proof that the fall changed everything in regard to leisure. But the Bible also paints brief pictures of perverted leisure. After the fall, leisure has had the potential to degenerate into immoral activities and triviality. The book of Ecclesiastes provides haunting pictures of the emptiness of leisure that the quester experienced when he turned leisure into his central life interest. His futile experiment began with the decision, "I said in my heart, come now, I will make a test of pleasure. Enjoy yourself." What followed was a litany of cheap and tawdry leisure pursuits. "I searched how to cheer my body with wine. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, man's delight." In that same passage, it is obvious that the wealthy quester went shopping on a grand scale, recreational shopping in a courtly mode. Further, "I kept my heart from no pleasure, and this was the reward for all my toil." We know that the author is talking about leisure because leisure is a reward for toil, something we enjoy after we have worked to make it possible. And what was the result of this pursuit of leisure apart from God? Emptiness. We read, "Behold, all was vanity, that is, vapor, and a striving after wind." There's an important lesson here. Despite all my enthusiasm for leisure, it needs to come as a byproduct or reward from something more substantial than leisure itself. Part of the restorative value of leisure is that it offsets the rigors of work. It is like dessert after the main meal. Just as dessert cannot carry an entire meal, leisure cannot give purpose to a whole life. So if we're going to pursue our calling of leisure in a Christian manner, we need to do so in an awareness that in a fallen world, not all leisure pursuits are healthy for the soul or pleasing to God. Another body of data in the Bible is the Old Testament prescriptions of an annual calendar of religious festivals or feasts. Before I unpack the biblical data, let me reply to what is an entirely plausible initial resistance to what I'm about to say. Aren't the Old Testament religious festivals strictly worship experiences like our Sunday morning worship services? My answer is no. They were more like the evangelical institution of a Christian summer camp. Certainly, worship was a central part of the annual Old Testament events, but there was a social and celebrative aspect as well. I consider them a form of religious and spiritual leisure. What does the Old Testament say about these events? First, there were six annual required festivals. They go by such names as holy convocations and appointed feasts. They were accompanied by strict prohibition of work. I think they resembled our Thanksgiving Day celebrations when observed as a day of thanks to God with a church service as part of the mix. When Moses recapitulated the rules of religious festivals originally recorded in Leviticus 23, three of them were expanded to include annual pilgrimages to Jerusalem. These were group events that included camping out. They were so communal that Jesus' parents, I infer, left him behind in Jerusalem by mistake, just assuming that he was part of some other family's entourage. In Nehemiah 8, we catch a glimpse of what the Feast of Booths was like. The people went out from the city to the hills, where they built makeshift booths from tree branches. On the occasion of the rediscovery of the law recorded in Nehemiah 8, the camping trip lasted 7 days. One reason I put the Old Testament religious festivals into the category of leisure is that they put a halt to work, and that is an essential feature of leisure. A second reason is that they had some of the physical and social properties of leisure. I would call these festivals and feasts sanctified leisure. I have adduced 5 categories of data from the Bible: the rest of God, the example of Jesus, the fourth commandment, the fall, and Old Testament religious festivals. Together, they establish a rationale for us to find a place for leisure in our lives, and in the case of the fall, a caution not to let our guard down about the possibility of inappropriate forms of leisure in our lives. I want to make one more argument for the necessity of leisure based on inferences about the kind of people God created us to be. I would call this a Christian principle, but not an explicit biblical teaching. An evangelical author titled one of his books, "Your Right to Rest." I think that if we look at what people are like, The book title understates the case. We do not simply have a right to rest, we have a need for it. Living responsibly includes living in accordance with the kind of creatures God made us. Our mental, physical, and emotional well-being requires that we rest and refresh ourselves and take breaks from work. Burnout is an established phenomenon in our culture, and a study of employees in 18 public and private organizations found that just under half of the workers suffered from psychological burnout. The chief cause is excessive work and insufficient leisure. Burnout is not God's goal for people. The person who coined the word workaholic speaks of the self-deception of trying to live as if we did not have a body subject to certain limitations. One of the limitations of the human body is that it cannot work nonstop. It needs rest and leisure. For my address to you this evening, I rated my book Redeeming the Time, and I was very favorably impressed by the following sentence in that book. Because we are physical creatures subject to physical and psychological laws, to have regular times of leisure is to live in accord with the Creator's plan for us. We need to live in keeping with how God made us. We are wired to seek reward for our work. I have always found evocative the phrase in Ecclesiastes 4:9 about people having, quote, a good reward for their toil. Leisure is one of the good rewards for our toil. For the person who works in the world or the homemaker who works in the home, the thought of what happens at the end of the day with the evening meal and the relaxation that follows it is a reward that they look forward to. Without that reward in view, work is robbed of much of its incentive. I have made my best case for regarding leisure as a Christian calling. I'm ready to turn to applications, and these are intended to supplement why leisure is a calling with thoughts on how leisure can be a Christian calling. I want to return to what I have called the secular datum on leisure. Leisure theorists have evolved a paradigm called the time continuum. That continuum consists of 24 hours in every day. On one end of the continuum, we find work and obligation. On the other end, we find freedom from obligation and the ability to choose what we want to do. We call this leisure. I will note that it is the leisure theorists who bring time into the equation rather than theorists on work. Perhaps that is because we have to find time for work. We have to take time for work, whereas we have to find time for leisure. My own writing on the subject of work and leisure is somewhat distinctive, not only because I discuss both work and leisure, but also because I bring time into the equation. Not only will we not solve the problems of work and leisure if we do not take the other into consideration, we also will not solve these problems if we do not take time into consideration. Work and leisure share the time continuum. We cannot add to one without subtracting from the other. The time continuum thus brings an element of realism into the discussion. Experts on time, work, and leisure have also evolved a category in the middle of the time continuum that they call semi-leisure. This refers to activities that are a mixture of obligation or work and freedom or leisure. The degree to which activities in the middle of the continuum belong to one or the other depends on how we regard that experience. Examples of semi-leisure activities are serving on a committee, driving a child or grandchild to an event, gardening, and decorating a room. For some people, these fall into the categories of work, while for others, they have qualities of leisure. Physical exercise can be drudgery or it can be leisure. The reason I find the concept of semi-leisure worth its weight in gold is that it opens the possibility of nudging more and more features of my life into the category of pleasure rather than obligation. There is so much work in most of our lives that we need all the help we can get on the side of leisure. If I can rescue an activity from the realm of work and obligation just by how I choose to regard it, that is really liberating. I'm not saying that we can change all activities in the middle of the continuum simply by thinking about them in a certain way. But I am reminded of a motto used by a Wheaton College football coach of long ago that life is 90% attitude. I like to use that motto around the Riken household. Life is 90% attitude. It is possible to nudge activities that initially seem like work into activities that seem more like leisure simply by consciously cultivating a certain stance toward them. On the negative side, I have to also say, I have found that some semi-leisure activities, such as volunteer work or doing extra work for pay, often begin as leisure activities that seem like play, and then gradually assume the qualities of work and drudgery. My first practical application is that we can make creative use of something called semi-leisure. My second application is that we all need to take stock periodically of where we stand in regard to leisure in our lives. The first thing we need to resolve is whether or not we believe that leisure is a Christian calling in the sense that God requires it. If we don't believe that, probably we do not need to analyze our leisure situation further. So I'd encourage you to decide, how convincing is the case for leisure as a calling from God? Is it really strong? Does God want you to play as well as work? Would it be good for your family, as well as for you, to open the leisure door wider than it currently stands? These questions and promptings have to do with the quantitative side of leisure. They answer the question of whether you are currently finding enough time for leisure in your life. That does not yet answer the qualitative question of whether your leisure is all that it should be, but it is like a qualifying exam that you need to pass. If you are not finding sufficient time for leisure, your leisure life is deficient. Any amount of time for leisure is better than no time. I wrote my books on work and leisure during what I call the child-rearing years, and I remember to this day writing the following sentence in regard to finding time for leisure. Quote, "For some people, during some eras of their life, there are no easy answers." I was writing from personal experience. In other eras of life, the time is there, and it is a question of willpower and priorities to find time for leisure. My next application is one on which I hesitate to embark, but I think it needs to be put on the table. I think the time crunch on leisure is potentially more pronounced for Christians because of the category of Christian ministry, including ministry in the church. The sense of duty runs strong in most Christians. I also acknowledge that church work is a combination of duty or obligation and pleasure. Nonetheless, I think that Christian ministry greatly reduces the amount of leisure in some people's lives. We can argue about how bad this is, but we need to be forthright about how much leisure is lost for some people because of church work. Does God build a compensating element into such people's lives? To some degree, yes. But Jesus plainly commanded the disciples to get away from the press of the crowd and spend some time by themselves. Families are losers when one or both parents or spouses overwork and skimp on leisure. The overwork can happen at church. I have talked about the quantity of leisure in our lives as a sphere in which we need to take stock and potentially make changes, but quantity is only half of the equation, and perhaps an area in which your achievement is exactly what it should be. Many people can upgrade the quality of their leisure life, and perhaps should upgrade it. In support of that proposition, let me introduce the idea of stewardship. Our leisure is as much a sphere of stewardship as our work. Perhaps because I am a literature professor who thinks readily in terms of leisure, when I assimilate Jesus' parable of the talents, I am thinking as much about stewardship in leisure as about stewardship in work. God entrusts time and opportunity for leisure to us. All of the usual rules of stewardship apply. God wants a return on what he has entrusted to us. He wants us to be all that we can be in our leisure lives. What is the takeaway element in my remarks to you this evening? I will begin at the individual level. When I compose an address, I first of all envision my listeners. So I did compose this address with you in mind. However, when I survey the total leisure scene as it exists in the evangelical world, you are frankly the least of my worries. Still, my address was designed to raise your and my awareness and conscience in regard to leisure. My consciousness and conscience were raised as I composed this address, and there were some points at which I felt convicted. To the extent that these things are true for you, this would be a point of application to you personally. People starting out in a teaching and scholarly career, and people in the prime of such, struggle to find enough time for leisure. If you fall into those categories, you might take stock of where you are in light of what I have said. If you are married, that affects the leisure aspect of your life. And if you have children in the house or married children near at hand, that complicates the picture. These things make leisure even more important, but also more difficult to achieve because the list of domestic duties is so long. I can imagine that most of you, and perhaps all of you, have a good record in regard to the quantity of leisure in your life. But what about the other half of the equation, namely the quality of your leisure life? I am somewhat haunted by the Christian leisure theorist who said that leisure is the growing time for the human spirit, the growing time for the human spirit. With that high ideal in our awareness, I want to shift my focus from the individual level to the family level, both in regard to you personally and the evangelical church at large. I believe that parents are responsible for educating their children in leisure. Whatever people do in their leisure time reflects their education in regard to leisure. I say that because we do in our leisure time what we have learned to do. Learning is a synonym for education. This education might be self-education, or it might be education at the family level. There was a time when public and Christian schools assumed responsibility to educate people for leisure, but I cannot see that it happens today. I think that the record of homeschooling is quite good in regard to education for leisure. Let me focus for a moment on our young people. My impression is that their education in leisure is largely left to them instead of being directed by parents or other adults. This strikes me as leisure by default. What is the default mode? Texting, computer games and other computer activities, movies, and socializing. In other words, something that appears on a screen, plus hanging out. There was a time when children became readers by osmosis. Yes, by catching the spirit from family members and peers. One of the papers I assign in my literature courses is a formal defense of literature, and I encourage my students to include winsome anecdotes of early childhood experiences of being read to or reading. In earlier years, I received heartwarming and charming anecdotes. These have largely vanished for a very good reason. When I recently spoke at Patrick Henry College, contrarywise, which has largely a homeschool student body, my contact person assured me that childhood anecdotes about reading from his students are as plentiful as ever. My larger point is that whatever the leisure activity is, what a gift it is from parents to produce a child who leads a rich leisure life in adulthood. Let me return to the stewardship of leisure. We should want to be all that we can be in regard to leisure time. God wants us to have an abundant life. Who is calling parents and young people to their higher selves in regard to leisure? So far as I can tell, no one. If it is happening, it is because individuals and couples have caught the vision and taken the initiative. Who should be calling people to their higher selves in regard to leisure? Well, the minister is in some sense responsible for seeing that the important aspects of the Christian life are being addressed in a local church. I was very favorably impressed when I discovered that New England Puritan Cotton Mather preached a sermon on how to employ the leisure of the winter for the glory of God. It is important that Christians have the right attitudes about work and leisure. After all, work and leisure make up most of their time. Sermons are one place to inculcate right thinking on these topics, but I would not insist on it if it does not seem natural. Adult Sunday school classes and small groups may be the best possible place to address the topics of work and leisure, because the members are the ones who are confronting work and leisure day by day. But someone needs to take the lead in prompting Sunday school classes and small groups to address the subjects of vocation, work, and leisure. Where are ministers likely to become convinced that instilling right thinking about work and leisure is an important part of their task? I would say during their seminary education. In a sense, I'm handing you a job description tonight, and I hope that is not presumptuous on my part. I don't think that education in the principles of vocation and work and leisure needs to be incorporated into the seminary curriculum, though I certainly am in favor of it if it can happen. It can be handled informally in your classes. Do you have class devotions? You could slant them toward work and leisure over a period of weeks. Or you could simply say, I am convinced that right thinking about work and leisure is so important that I'm going to insert 10-minute modules on these topics into our class sessions for several weeks. I would not say that the current state of leisure in the church and among Christians is the cause of a certain disintegration that we find troubling, but I think that leisure is an arena in which the current crisis is particularly evident. I think, for example, of how indistinguishable many evangelicals' leisure life, especially among the young, is from our surrounding secular culture. Would raising the tenor of leisure activities raise the tenor of Christian living in other areas? It might. At the very least, a low level of attainment in leisure represents a missed opportunity, and we all hate missed opportunities. I will conclude with the following epigraph from Frank Gebelein. The very word leisure implies responsibility. We are accountable for the stewardship of our leisure as well as of our working time.